In this segment of the IEEE project to record some of the history of radio and electronics in South Australia, I'm speaking today to Mr. David Cox. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Ian.
Maybe we could commence by you telling us how you first became interested in radio or electronics, or how you sort of got involved in this yourself in your early days.
That goes back a long way. I did a science course at the university, specialising in physics. And although the physics course didn't include very much electronics, I developed some interest in trying to put together a radio receiver, which I managed to do in my third university year with some help. And the understanding of how it operated in some sort of detail was a challenge to me, which I more or less mastered in some sort of fashion. But my first job was at the School of Mines, where just for 1 year I was standing in for a fellow called Wilf Honor, who took a job with AWA. And let's get that right. He went off for a year's study leave, and I replaced him. And part of my duties were to take the fairly elementary classes in what we call Wireless 1 and Wireless 2. These were evening classes provided mainly for the hobbyists in Adelaide who wanted some understanding of the new hobby that they were interested in. So I ran these two evening courses for 12 months. 3 or 4 years later, I was offered a full-time position at the School of Mines. I became a lecturer in the maths and physics department, but past my assigned duties were to again take these classes in Wireless 1, Wireless 2, and in addition, a Saturday morning class which was called Electronics. It was really a course in applied electronics, and again it was open to those who had an interest in knowing a bit about the applications of electronics, not for communication for purposes, but for measurement and control in industry. The electronics side of education developed post-war, and it wasn't long before the School of Mines thought it proper to set up a department which was one of radio engineering, they called it, but it did include radio from the receiving, transmitting points of view, and in addition electronics. So I suppose the answer to your question is that I had this natural interest in electronics through my study of physics and this opportunity of becoming involved.
Could I just ask you, how complicated was that first radio that you built? Would that have been in the Super Het?
No, the first one was a two-valve with a reaction coil, which you probably know. Oh, yes. If you put too much reaction on, you got it to squeal. And my second effort was a Super Het. I had to have several goes at the wiring of that to make it work. My wiring technique wasn't that good to start with.
Did you run practical classes in that sort of thing too?
Oh, yes. We had, again, these were very simple, I think, and a set of experiments was what we provided for the students. There wasn't much hands-on construction of anything for quite some time. Eventually, we provided a radio technician certificate course, which had receiving, transmitting and radio servicing as subject. We even had a subject, radio engineering design. Not quite sure how useful that was, but it was in the course. And radio calculations for those who didn't have very much mathematics.
What would that have been providing for? Not that would have been going beyond the servicing people then, wouldn't it? Would that be for,
yes,
broadcasting and
Yes, we put together various subjects, and those who wanted to go for their broadcast operators or their could select certain subjects from our course and then submit themselves for the examination. You know, in hindsight, I think we might have designed more appropriate courses, but you live and learn, of course, in this game. And still, the interest was there. We usually had quite substantial classes. And until the Radio Trade School took it over in the mid-1950s, was it?
Yes, I think it would have been about 56 or something like that, I think, yes.
Was there a in-between stage with the Commonwealth Reconstruction Training School?
Yes, that was in a sense imposed on the course. The CRTS students joined in the courses that were provided by the School of Mines. We didn't run special groups for them, although I believe for a while we had some daytime students who were available through the day, and we then provided some work in the daytime for them.
And would they have been doing this technician certificate
course?
Yes,
they took subjects from the technician's course. Yes.
Did you have any liaison with the Melbourne Technical College?
Not really. We became familiar with what they were doing, and two or three times I made visits over there to see what they were doing. And I guess, you know, consciously or unconsciously, we modelled ourselves a bit on their approach. They made a study over there of what the radio servicemen and the radio apprentice should be taught. One of the first studies made. Their principal at that time, a man called McKay, I think. He initiated this. In fact, I think he himself had quite a bit to do with this study. So in a sense, they got going before we did on a well-conceived course for radio apprentices.
These people that were doing this rehabilitation course, they were ex-Army and Air Force, Navy people, and were they already working, or were they doing this to try and gain employment in the industry?
Well, a bit of each, I think. Yes, some of them were working in, say, clerical jobs and thought they might want to change. Others doubtless wanted to know more about their subject to, you know, for promotional purposes and so on.
What about amateur radio? Was that involved in those days, in the courses?
Yes, I think we had a list of recommended subjects for those who wanted to get their amateur operator certificate, plus some training in Morse. We had a fellow called Bill Gill there who ran the Morse classes, and that was quite active for quite some time.
Well, perhaps you might be able to tell us in a bit how the courses that you were involved with developed after the trade school, or perhaps technician courses, and they were developed before the trade school took over the trade courses, weren't they?
Yes, well, there came a time when the technician's courses at the Institute were abandoned in favour of the Radio Trade School. For a few years, I think, we ran in parallel, but eventually it was policy of the Institute to abandon, if you like, the courses which of a level appropriate to apprentices. And this happened, of course, not only in radio, but in electrical and mechanical and other trades as well. at that time, our attention turned, in a sense, to the professional courses. In 1956-57, there were discussions at the School of Mines about the providing or doing the teaching for a degree course, the BTEC degree course. And eventually there was an agreement reached with the Adelaide University that the School of Mines would do the teaching. The university would award the degree. That meant that all the teaching had to have the approval of the corresponding professor at the university, and so each year I had to declare the syllabus to the professor, Professor Willoughby in my case, and show him the examination papers. That lasted for 4 or 5 years. Otherwise, there was no vetting of the university by the university of our work. But we operated through a faculty of technology, and half the members were university staff, half were institute staff, so that they, in a sense, had a control and were able to determine the content and the standard of the course. It was a 3-year course, and in electronic engineering it got going very well. I should add that there are 4 or 5 engineering departments that took on the BTEC: mechanical, civil, electrical, electronic. Surveying came into it at a later time. The electronic engineering course was in demand. At that time there were still men in the PMG and the Weapons Research Establishment, was it called then, who were graduating from the technician level, and they were able to get time off from work to do a course, in some cases full-time, in some cases part-time. These were mature people who were prepared to settle down to study. It was a chance of a lifetime for them, from their point of view. Most of them were young married men and took the thing quite seriously, and also had the advantage of having some experience in the field. So they set the standard, in a sense, and we did have a few straight from school boys, and these younger fellows were sort of kept in line by their older colleagues, so that we got off to a good start.
So some of the experience rubbed off on the young ones.
Electronic engineering, yes.
You mentioned Professor Willoughby. He's, as far as I understand, a notable character in South Australia's early days. Can you tell us anything about him?
Oh, he was a Melbourne man, I think, by training. Had experience, had his field experience with STC. I know he was in transmitting stations in India for a while. Then came to Adelaide University, I think the first professor of electrical engineering. Prior to that, there was a professor of engineering, and he encompassed all the branches of engineering, Professor Chapman. But Professor Willoughby, I think I'm right in saying the first professor of electrical, moves into a new building not far from the School of Mines, Bar Smith, Blythe and Jubilee building. And developed the department at the university, I think, very successfully. His particular interest was on propagation antennas, and I can recall at least one occasion which he addressed the IRE, on the subject.
I suppose that would have been a key topic in those days, wouldn't it? Like the equipment was available, but
right.
Things like shortwave radio, I know the Beam Wireless Service started that. That didn't involve Adelaide, I don't think, did it, but it did involve Melbourne and Sydney. And I guess it was a time when propagation and aerials were
really...
Yes,
well, the VHF and the UHF links
were
being developed. And not quite sure how much work he did for the PMG, but I think they were certainly very interested in the experiments that he was doing with in propagation.
I think you mentioned before we started this tape about Professor Sir Kerr Grant too. He was also a propagation man, did you say?
I don't know whether that was his particular interest, but certainly he kept himself well informed on a lot of topics. Well, he was my professor when I did my course in 32 to 35. I did an honours course actually in 36. But he was very active in the IRE and a very popular speaker. At least once a year he would address the IRE meetings. He wasn't that well informed on the fine detail of radio, the circuitry for example, but he was very well informed on the more academic topics such as propagation, the electromagnetic spectrum. He interested all one evening in going right through the spectrum from long waves to cosmic radiation and giving us a rundown on the features of each and the uses of each. And he told more than once the story of the early experiments that were made in Adelaide in wireless telegraphy, I think was the phrase that was used. This was at the turn of the century when Sir Charles Todd was, I think, still Postmaster General. And the Professor of Physics, the name still escapes me, married Sir Charles Todd's daughter, as a matter of fact, but I can't think of his name. He and Sir Charles were involved in early experiments in 1899 or 1900, around about there. And they succeeded, first of all, in transmitting between the Adelaide University and the observatory, which was then at West Terrace, and later on from the city down to Henley Beach, where they set up a little little receiving station. Their hope was that they'd be able to communicate with the Althorps, the islands in Spencer Gulf, is it, or somewhere?
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure why they wanted to communicate there, but this was must have been some advantage in being able to get quick messages to the Althorps.
Maybe it was a propagation
shipping
across water or something like
could
that.
Be that, maybe. Yes. Mm. Kerr Grant had a technician, a man called Rogers, who was at the university in his time, 1920s I guess, but this man Rogers was a wizard at glass blowing, and he made up some of the early coherers, I think is the expression, the thing, the device that can detect a radio signal. So there's a lot of homemade equipment in this transmitting equipment that they used. They had some contact with Marconi, so they knew what he was doing over the other side of the world. I mean, not radio contact, but conversation when they went travelling, when they visited England. So they got some help and advice from him in their first efforts at communicating. But it was a very interesting story that Kerr Grant told in some detail. As I say, I don't think he was there at the event, but he got the information and thought it of great interest.
He wasn't all that far behind Marconi then, was he? You know, Marconi's first message between England and Australia was 1906, wasn't it?
Yes, early 1900.
No, true, that's right. It was very close on Marconi's efforts, yes.
Yes. I believe Sir Kerr Grant.
The name of the man I'm thinking of is Bragg, William Bragg.
Oh,
Sir William Bragg,
right.
Hence the Bragg Laboratory, so
yes. Yes. Well, where were we? Well, this is one of Professor Kerr Grant's topics that we found interesting. Milton Gooley has written this up. I don't know whether in a little book that may still be available.
Yes, published for the IRE.
Oh, yes.
All back 40 years ago, I think.
Mm. Yeah. The other people I remember in the IRE, there was Bill Bland, was it, who ran, who was owned a factory making radio sets?
Mm-hmm. Yes, down South Road. Or he
was it Bill Bland? The name was Bland.
Started out at Fruville, first of all.
Yes. Mm. Then down on the South Road somewhere. Yes. It was, yes. Governlock of Newton McLaren, what was his name? Bill?
Bill Governlock,
yes. He was secretary, wasn't he, for a long time?
Yes.
Wasn't a technical man, but gave a lot of valuable time and assistance to the IRE. Don Gooding, who was at 5AD,
yes,
was a member. Reg George.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sketching now for... These are people on the committee, I expect, and who guided the IRE in its early days.
You were not a foundation in the foundation group, were you?
No. Ted McGrath was in demand for addressing the meeting on various aspects of radio communication. And... O'Grady, what was his name?
Frank O'Grady.
Frank O'Grady, mm. Yes. From time to time would make his contribution.
Yes.
They had an annual radio founders dinner, didn't they?
Yeah. Pity that's been discontinued.
Yeah. Yes. I can't recall very clearly many of the subjects that were presented at the meetings. The meetings were, I don't know how frequently, I don't know whether they were monthly in those days.
It was monthly for a start.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know on one occasion I spoke to them on what amounted to radio receiver design. I think I found some interest in the detail of the the design features of the Super Heterodyne receiver, and try to interest the group in things like that. Not quite sure whether it was a very appropriate topic or not, but I thought it was a topic that was well worth them knowing about, just the theory of it in a sense. And
I suppose in those times radio broadcasting, transmission, reception were really developing as fairly significant parts of people's lives, weren't they?
Yes.
From an engineering aspect,
yes.
I guess the broadcasting people would have been pretty interested in such things.
Yes, well, my approach, having done the theories in a sense before I came to the practical, was always tended to be to know how things work, give the most adequate explanation you could, and then I had some interest in the design features, why, for example, you choose 465 kilocycles for the IF frequency, or what was the other one, 175?
175,
wasn't it?
Yes.
Pros and cons of one against the other, mm-hmm. things like this.
Yeah.
Now, the serviceman, of course, is not particularly interested in knowing why one is chosen preference to the other, but still, I was, and I thought that the IRE people might want to know.
I guess in those times, that was when the frequency had just changed from 175 up to 465 or 455 or whatever.
Yeah.
And I guess the service people who used to do, repair everything in those times, didn't they?
Yes.
They would have been...
They had to cope with it.
Yeah, would have had some involvement and want to know...
Yeah.
Well, I guess they had experienced a problem with people getting, double...
Yes.
Like image problems when you get more and more broadcast stations on the air.
Yeah.
There was even an American receiver that used an intermediate frequency of around about 250 kilohertz.
Yes, I do believe that. That was common way back in those times, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, well, it's nothing... you know, you've got a free go, haven't you, to what you choose.
Do you want to have a break there for a minute, Cliff, and we'll just perhaps...
During the war, we received a request at the School of Mines for providing instruction for personnel of the Army and also the Air Force. These young men were camped in Adelaide and they did a 3 months full-time course preparing them for to become radio mechanics to serve in the forces. And it was my task to provide the instruction for them. So we had groups of typically about 20 to 25 students who were marched to the classroom in the morning and home again late afternoon. And I had to provide the instruction in a set course, a course set by the Army, both in lectures and practical work. The course lasted 3 months, and I think there were four or five of these courses that followed end on and kept me going for at least 18 months. Some equipment was provided. The Army provided their own sets, transmitting, receiving, and transceivers. And part of my duties were to give instruction in the features of these sets. Not so much the operation of them, but at least the features. The one group, I think, was involved in instruction in the Morse code. This was taken by Bill Gill. Others were given instruction in navigation by the mathematics, head of the mathematics department, George Haskard. This led on eventually to the Commonwealth Technical Training Scheme, which was controlled by our Education Department. The key man at that time was Mr. John Walker, who was the Superintendent of Technical Education, at least if not then, but later. But our School of Mines buildings were made available for this purpose, and for several years we had part of the Benythe and Jubilee building available to the Commonwealth Technical Training Scheme. They set up laboratories very adequately with benches, equipment, and when it was no longer required at the end of the war, it was made available to the School of Mines. But I wasn't directly involved in the instruction under the CTTS label. They found their own staff for that.
You've mentioned Bill Gill as being one of your helpers there. Were you virtually it as far as the radio?
Yes, this was my rather difficult position, that I was the only full-time person. Bill Gill and myself were the only full-time personnel in the department at that time, and we had to rely on part-time instructors, you know, quite an army of them, some 12 to 15
were they?
Or so part-time instructors we had.
Because most of the classes would have been classes. The evenings, yes.
So for several years I had a very lopsided program, very heavy for the evening, but not much to do during the day.
Any notable characters amongst those part-time people that we would know about, or that had particular expertise or experiences?
No, they. I think typically they were a fairly, I was going to say prosaic, but a fairly ordinary type of person who had certainly an interest in their subject of radio electronics, whatever aspect it was.
Where would they have come from?
Or from the industry mainly. Electricity Trust supplied quite a number. I can recall the names of Morris Phillips and Don Baker and Keith Gunn, all Electricity Trust men who performed part-time for us. Jack DeCure was a man from the PMG who helped us out for quite a long time. Some came only for a year and then found that they couldn't carry on.
Yes.
Others were with us for longer.